Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to this RCG podcast on patients with a learning disability. My name is Dirk Pilat. I'm a salaried GP and the medical director for professional development at the RCGP. Today we are talking to Catherine Peterson, a GP partner at the Forum Family Practice in Cramlington. She is the strategic clinical lead for mental health, learning disability and neurodivergence for North East and North Cumbria Integrated Care Board. And she's the clinical representative and co-chair of the Special Interest Group for Learning Disabilities here at the RCGP. Hello, Catherine.
Hi, Dirk. Lovely to see you.
Listen, we've got quite a bit to go through, so we'll just get started. How did you get involved with looking after people with a learning disability in general practice?
Oh, thanks for asking. So when I was a young salaried GP within the practice about 20 years ago, I was asked by the practice to set up the annual health checks. These were new from the government. And I attended an education session with one of my practice nurses, and we set these annual health checks up, and I did them every week on a Friday lunchtime. I did them alone for many, many years. But over time, we got more than 100 patients in our practice to have an annual health check every year. We have a supported living environment on our patch. So I was suddenly doing a lot more, and I realised that I needed help. So I now share it with colleagues in the practice. Over this time, I recognised people perhaps who weren't brought to their appointments, and I went on to do a lot of work on that. I went on to work with other specialists and other people in other disciplines, multidisciplinary teams across Northumberland where I work. And I got interested in the continuity of care, how we recognised frail patients, how we recognised deterioration in sepsis. And eventually in 2017 was asked to be the clinical lead in Northumberland in the CCG as was then. And I've gone on to train other colleagues, to do training for GPs in training. And in recognition of the work that I do in inequalities, I've ended up having a much wider role in the ICB and obviously in the RCGP. And I co-chair the special interest group that you mentioned now with a colleague, Alison Taveray, and we both are very involved in quality improvement for people with learning disability and their carers and supporters. So as you say, I now work for the ICB.
That's a vast experience in looking after people with learning disabilities, isn't it?
Yeah, many, many years, and actually lots and lots of people, so lots of patient hours as well. And I've learned about all the difficult experiences that they have getting the care that they need and the help that they need to get support in other health settings. So it's been a really interesting journey.
Yeah, when you mentioned that that you worked on getting the help that they need, while working with you over the last few weeks on our upcoming module on people with learning disability, I noticed some of the shocking statistics, particularly the fact that people with a learning disability died 20 years younger than the average population. Why is that?
Yes, it's a horrifying statistic, isn't it? And it hasn't changed very much for many years. So there's lots of reasons. We have annually a report that comes out from the Learning from Lives and Deaths in Learning Disability. We call it LEADER. And the last report is from data from 2024. And it shows that the most common causes for people dying 20 years too young is cardiovascular disease, pneumonia and respiratory disease, cancer, neurological, for example, dementia, and congenital conditions. Now, the other horrifying statistic is lots of these deaths deemed as preventable. So, for example, infections that we could have vaccinated against, and avoidable. And by that, we mean there were missed opportunities for better care. And LEADER tells us every year where those opportunities were and how we could do things differently. Unfortunately, these things are very difficult to do. We work in systems, and these systems are not easily changed for people with a learning disability. One of the main things at the moment is reasonable adjustments, that the idea that we can change the way we do things to fit around personalised care. So, for example, a person with a learning disability might need their trusted carer with them for all appointments. They might need a capacity assessment every time they're seen. They might need to have extra appointments, easy read information. There's lots of different reasonable adjustments. And we are currently embedding a digital way of documenting these reasonable adjustments in our clinical systems across primary, secondary care, dental, optometry, pharmacy. and other healthcare settings. So having those reasonable adjustments will make a huge difference for people to get access to the care that they need. When they get that care, when they attend an appointment, hopefully with a trusted carer, we need to be really clear that we are not attributing new symptoms to the learning disability. We call that diagnostic overshadowing. The idea that actually we need to look at why that person is presenting in that way. When we talk about children and people with a dementia, we don't assume that the symptoms they are having are due to the illness or their age. We have to assume, we have to think about why. And I think we need to do that better. There's lots of work to do on that professional curiosity. The other thing for me is that we don't know exactly who this population of people with a learning disability is. There aren't good diagnostic services to identify people. We think from statistics that about 2% of the population should have a learning disability. As a country, we only have documented record of 0.4% of the population having a learning disability. So there's a huge gap. We call that the missing millions. The other thing for people with a learning disability is they often live in the most deprived areas and deciles of our society. So their access to good lifestyle information, food, good quality food, fuel, good quality housing is limited. So that makes a huge difference to their ability to look after themselves well and live well. And just one other point, that it's very difficult to recognise frailty in a person with a learning disability. Our electronic systems identify frailty using numbers of conditions and other electronic measures. This doesn't really work for people with a learning disability, or it doesn't work so well, and we haven't got anything that is there in their place. And it's very difficult to understand the risk of sepsis or see deterioration if you don't know these patients well. Their baseline measurements might be very different from other people. And we know that lots of people with learning disability are at risk of other co-occurring conditions, for example, epilepsy, respiratory disease, cardiovascular disease, there's lots, constipation. So co-occurring conditions layer up, and we also have risks of polypharmacy. And obviously, all of you will be aware of the Stomp Stamp campaigns about how to reduce the over-medication with antipsychotics for people who don't have a co-occurring diagnosis of a severe mental illness. And we know that when we layer medications on each other, that they can have increasing side effects and interactions that can be dangerous. Just briefly going back to constipation, about 17% of the population of people with a learning disability have constipation. It's very difficult to monitor poos of people who are not seen going to the toilet every single day. So the risk of constipation and the impact of it is high. And we have really sadly had people who have died with constipation. If we're thinking about how to do this better, how do we do this differently? We need to think about how we prevent illnesses. We need to make sure that we are diagnosing, for example, respiratory and cardiovascular conditions properly, and making sure that people are having excellent oral health, good dental care, good access to vaccination. And this is vaccination with, I guess, reasonable adjustments to make it easier for people. But we really need to increase our uptake of vaccinations.
Why do you think so few people are being coded with a learning disability nationally?
I think this is a really difficult question. We do not have national diagnostic services. There's not an expectation of national diagnostic services, particularly for adults who may have missed a diagnosis in childhood. We do have an inclusion tool, which has been developed by Leeds, that can give you a likelihood of learning disability. And we then have the situation where some of our specialist services can't see these patients unless they have a diagnosis. So we have a real gap here in how we identify this population. So some practices seem to be have it better. There are ways of looking at our clinical codes, for example, for genetic conditions that might give an 80% chance of a learning disability, but obviously you still need to see and talk to your patient to see if that's actually true. But the inclusion tool can give you a bit more of an idea about whether that is a learning disability or not. But yeah, I think identification would be a really big thing for me in terms of how would we improve things.
So the e-learning course addresses that. So now that we have a functioning, hopefully up-to-date, a list of people with learning disability, when we get them in for their annual health check, how do you think this improves the healthcare for those patients?
Thank you for asking that. It is obviously a yearly check-in, which, you know, for lots of people with long-term conditions, you may well be having a conversation all year about their various long-term conditions and including their acute exacerbations. But for me, we need to consider holistic care and the common co-occurring conditions that affect people with a learning disability. For example, constipation, which we've talked about, but dysphagia, respiratory conditions, where we can diagnose things sooner. We know that people with a learning disability also struggle with things like obesity, making it more likely that they become diabetic or have fatty liver disease, and we need to be better at personalising the care for example, weight gain for patients. And we need to also involve social care here, making sure that social care have the right and time to spend with people doing activity, doing exercise and meal planning. For me, the annual health check, I've been doing these for patients, some of my patients, for 20 years. So I know these patients really well, and I know their families, and I use the opportunity to do a carer review. So getting to know people when they're well, seeing their observations and their clinical condition when they're well is really good. We can then plan their care, be proactive with it. For example, vaccination and cancer screening, which is really important that that's reasonably adjusted. And we can think about prevention and recognition of long-term conditions, for example, the diabetes. But it's an opportunity also to do a medication review, a polypharmacy review, think about STOMP if that's necessary. And I always use this time to consider missing medications, for example, a laxative plan for constipation, so that carers and family members and patients can recognise when that's needed and put it in place, a bit like a PRN medication, I guess. We also, as part of our annual health check, need to think about health action planning. This is the idea that we could write down and share with people who look after this person and the person any actions that might need to be followed up by other carers, for example, exercise or diet planning, healthy weight management. So we can write that down. We can write any referrals we have done, and we can write down any plans, such as attend all NHS appointments, attend your dental appointment, attend for your vaccination. And for some people, they can do their annual health checks around the time when they're doing flu vaccination, so they can actually flu vaccinate them at the time. And I would certainly do that in my practice. However, you can't do 100 health checks in September, October, and November when you're doing all your flu vaccination. So you just need to be, I guess, realistic about that. The other thing I think about then is the reasonable adjustments and making sure our records are updated in the reasonable adjustment digital flag. And we give out our health and care passports to make sure people have got up-to-date passports for any admissions or, for example, dental treatment. It's a really good good bit of time for your healthcare assistant, your practice nurse and your GP to really spend some time with that patient and carer and understand what are the issues for them at this time. What do we do in terms of proactive care to make sure that they are able to live well? And what do we also do to plan for care for the future? For example, it might be that that carer who's looking after that person in a family is getting really quite frail. So it might be time to think about, do we need social care in to reassess the situation to see if any more help is needed? So it is about getting to know that person. It is about continuity of care. It's about bringing care closer to home. So it fits really nicely with that neighbourhood model for patients. And it's about getting specialist care where needed. And for me, the reasonable adjustments are really important when you're making a referral. So if I'm referring, for example, for someone who has a suspected cancer, I want my care teams in secondary care to know that that person needs reasonable adjustments, and I might make a parallel referral to make sure that happens.
I certainly enjoy these annual health checks because compared to other appointments in my practice, I actually have some more time for the patient and the carer. And it's actually a lovely, lovely time to touch base. And I always really enjoy them. So annual health checks, important. What other initiatives do you think could help people with a learning disability to access care a little bit better?
So that's a really good question. And I've mentioned a couple of them. So reasonable adjustments digital flag, that is coming in all of our clinical systems. It's there now in primary care, in System 1 and EMIS, and it is there for us to document that person's personalised reasonable adjustments. Now, there are some standard things like needing a longer appointment or perhaps needing a carer or maybe needing a translator to make sure somebody can understand what's going on, having easy read resources. If we can document that in patients' notes, and when that is shared across the health and care system that will really help us understand how best to get that person access for the help and support that they need and to access the services they need. So that's a really important initiative, and you should be ready with your policies and your processes by September 2026. There's work in the background going on the annual health check quality. The annual health check hasn't been updated in our template since about 2016 when it was incepted, and we need to consider what LEADA, the Learning from Lives and Deaths in Learning Disability, is telling us about why people are becoming ill and dying early. So it would be really good to have all the up-to-date resources in there to make sure people have that access to information at the time when they're seeing people. We need to consider people who are not brought to their appointments. Everyone will know about children who are not brought to appointments. We don't write DNA for children. We shouldn't write that for vulnerable adults. It should be an adult not brought. And we need to think about people's capacity or capability to attend on their own. And we in my practice do assertive follow-up for people who haven't attended and make sure that we're making the reasonable adjustments and actually having an appointment at a time when it suits them and their carer. There is some work going on in NHS England around the quality of the annual health check and who does that annual health check, and that will be coming out, I hope, sometime in 2026, but I'm waiting on detail of that. And Alison and I, who are co-chairs of the Special Interest Group, are working with the JCVI to think about prevention, particularly around respiratory diseases. We know that our uptake of the flu vaccination is probably not as good as it could be, and we all need to work harder at that, I think. Think about capacity and reasonable adjustments here. But I think we also need to think more about actually who is eligible for our pneumococcal vaccination and try and get those done as well. We also need to think more about recognising frailty and deterioration and perhaps work on diabetes, HSSIB, so that's the Health Services Safety Investigation Board, are looking at the safety of insulin use for people with a learning disability, and certainly it's hard when your patients don't have capacity to use insulin to make sure that's done safely. So there's work on that going on. The other thing, just linking back to the reasonable adjustments, because reasonable adjustments is the most important thing here, is there's been a campaign from North East North Cumbria about all behaviour happens for a reason. So if someone is presenting with that behaviour and you try not to have that diagnostic overshadowing, but you might want to think about why that is. Is that person in pain? Have they got a sensory need that we're overlooking? Have they not got their carer with them? Have they not got something that they need and they're trying to communicate that? Behaviour is a communication, and it's often about distress. And we don't want people to be over-medicated in that setting. We want to understand why that person is not very well and think about how we best mitigate that. And part of our work on people who are not brought in North East North Cumbria has been about helping secondary care trusts understand how to manage people and understand what that presentation means.
So you've really well described what we can do locally in our own practice to become better doctors for our patients with learning disabilities. So in your role, I'm sure you know what's done nationally to support people with a learning disability. So can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, thank you. So the first bit to think about here, I think, is about quality improvement and educational resources. In each of your ICB areas, there will be quality improvement work going on. We've certainly done a lot in North East North Cumbria, and I know the same in the southwest of England with Alison. The other thing that will be happening for you at the moment in your areas is the Oliver McGough Mandatory Training in Learning Disability and Autism. Everyone who is clinically facing patients with a learning disability will be doing Tier 2 training, and that gives you a bit more of understanding about identification, recognition, and the key medical co-occurring conditions. And that is updated every 3 years. That's a really important quality measure. Every year we have a LEADA report which shares with us the common conditions that people are dying 20 years early of, and there are reports which give really good deep dives as well about the research and about what we can do differently. Over time, we are going to be learning more from the Health Services Safety Investigation Board and the National Confidential Inquiry into Patient Outcomes and Deaths, as they're both doing important work on learning disability. And we're hoping to clarify the vaccination guidance. Currently, if you look on nhs.gov UK and gov.uk, you get slightly different guidance about who needs a flu vaccination. So we need to clarify that for people to make sure that the information is right and the information is right for people who care for those people with learning disability. And I think all of these things will need to be collated better in the patient safety incident response framework. That's, we call that PSIRF. I think that's a really important way of making sure that everything that happens to people with a learning disability that is could be improved upon is collated somewhere, and we learn those lessons nationally, not just locally. I think the other important thing that Alison and I do is work with people with lived experience, with voluntary agencies, and we do lobbying. So if we think that there's something that could be done better, we are asking the RCGP or NHS England in how we can help to improve things. So that's been a really important part of that bit of our work. So we've been talking to the JCVI about pneumococcal vaccination recently. We try and, where we can, we try and influence upwards. Every year we do a one-day essential on learning disability. We have a number of talks across the day, which people from the RCGP can access. And just a shout out for a course which is run from Edgehill University called Medical Practice in Adult Learning Disability, which is a PG cert. You can have a look at that. There's lots of ways in which you can get involved. You can work with your PCN and practice leads. You can try and get involved in neighbourhood health initiatives and potentially ICB roles for the future. And there's always research going on in learning disability. Please link with us in the special interest group to think about how you can get more involved.
Well, that's all we have time for already. Catherine, thank you so much for your time and this tour de force into the topic. Thank you so much. People out there, if you want to know even more about the care for people with learning disabilities, please check out our new e-learning course and the new learning disability toolkit, which was created under the guidance of Catherine and her colleagues. And please, if you want to, hook up with the specialist interest groups on people with learning disabilities and contact Catherine and her colleagues. Many thanks and goodbye.
Thanks, Dirk.